Thanks, Pip. It's amazing how many things are actually in common through the three presentations, and we actually haven't had time to sync up our messages. And what's more interesting is both Pip and myself are using Microsoft Office and Microsoft PowerPoint. So, digital disruption. So how do you see this? Or do you see it as a risk? A risk that's littered across the industry. The biggest challenge in the environment for executives and directors is how to deal with that balance of an opportunity on one hand and risk on the other. The biggest risk, though, out of all of those issues and how to balance them is actually to do nothing at all and just wait until those waves of disruption come upon your company or society. For many, this has led to extinction. And some of those companies have been mentioned earlier. So Nokia, in spite of owning 30% of the mobile patents for GSMs, finds itself sitting on a burning platform and then had to jettison. Kodak invented the digital camera and then hid that away and couldn't commercialize it. General Motors invented the electric car 20 years ago and then decided that was going to eat into their mainstream products and didn't take it any further. And then you look at the many bookstores, the music industry, newspapers, all of whom were giants in their time, all are just struggling for survival and trying to avoid extinction. However, it's not all doom and gloom, and there are many opportunities in digital innovation, opportunities for growth and productivity. Over the next 15 minutes, I'll cover three things. Firstly, a definition of disruption in terms of how does it differ from continuous improvement. And then a quick look at the opportunities around us, particularly around Australia, and what that means for us. And then finally, how as a business do you deal with that disruption? How do you adapt in this environment of constant change? I hope by the end of that, you'll have a better understanding on why your organization should act, and act to try and harness the benefits from disruption by building it into the goals and DNA of your firm. So first on disruption. I'm not sure where the meaning of the word disruption started to be used for digital, but certainly when I was at school, the word was used by teachers many times. You know, stop being disruptive. You know, if you disrupt the class one more time, and so on. And of course, it was never actually said to me. It was always someone else. And I'm sure in looking at each of you, then it was never said to yourselves either. I'm sure we're all very well behaved. The name Clayton Christensen. How many of you have heard of Clayton Christensen? Not that many. So Clayton Christensen was and continues to be one of the key thought leaders around the world on innovation. He shaped many companies in terms of making them understand how to apply technology to grow and how to transform themselves and how to disrupt. He was instrumental in guiding Intel through a period of low growth, where he actually helped them come up with a low-end chip called the Celeron, which within a year actually disrupted Intel and took 35% of the market rapidly. He also was behind the culture that led to the invention of the electric car by GM. So a key thought leader who's written many books over the last 20 years around digital, and in particular, disruption and innovation. So a definition in terms of digital disruption, according to him, it offers a better alternative. It solves a customer problem, uses technology. It makes things quicker, cheaper, and more convenient. And it's radical, and it's not evolutionary change. And if we look around some examples to bring that to life, you know, in the 90s, the stockbroking business, disrupted by, in this country, ComSec, when that went online. iTunes disrupting the music industry and the software development industry. And then the pizza industry, disruption in the pizza industry. I can hear some of you thinking, well, how can you disrupt the pizza industry? That's pretty straightforward. But look at Domino Pizza. They openly declared 5 years ago that technology was going to play a key role in their business strategy. So have a look at the case study, Facebook ordering 3D pizzas, tracking where your pizza's up to. that grew their sales by 2 million within the first 3 months of launching a new iPhone app that provided all of that insight. As well as the companies that have disrupted, there are clearly, as we've seen, many failures, and some of them have been mentioned, but others that come to mind, you know, BlackBerry, Borders, then there's Kodak, some parts of General Motors. But there are many success stories, and there are many opportunities in the environment. So moving on to the second piece around the opportunities. If we take a look at the business environment, the velocity of change that we see now is unprecedented, and in many cases actually unpredictable. The waves of change are only growing in frequency. And if you just take a quick look at what's been happening in the IT industry over the last three decades, mainframes have been disrupted by mini computers. Mini computers were then disrupted by PCs. And if that wasn't enough, then the internet arrived, and that caused its own disruption. And then the era of mobile, and just when we think we've understood mobile, we've got wearable technology. And certainly on our table, we had a few who were wearing wearable technology. And then there's 3D printing, just about to disrupt, you know, medical, manufacturing, and many other industries. But this growth has primarily been driven out of the technology sector. But technology alone could not have done this. The insatiable demand from the businesses around the world has actually allowed the sector to grow. And the growth has been amazing. So if you look at this graph on the slide, you can start seeing in terms of the S&P sector weightings, the information technology sector over the last 15 years has actually been around 20% of the index, just below 20%. In the last 5 years in particular, it's actually been worth more than the financial sector, which is interesting in its own right. The spike you see around 2000, clearly the dot-com frenzy or the dot-com boom, Y2K, that accounts for the spike in that period. So a strong technology sector that's been growing globally through that insatiable demand from business. Another aspect to look at in terms of our environment is the patents, the extent of patents that have been lodged by the various sectors. And whilst that's not a direct indicator of emerging disruption, it certainly points to an environment of R&D and an environment of innovation and a potential disruption in the future. So when we look at the next chart, which is the global patents growth by sector, we see that, you know, over the last 10 years, technology has had a growth of a year-on-year growth of 14%. And if you look at related sectors such as electrical, digital, audio, they are tightly linked to technology. And so collectively, those four sectors actually account for a huge amount of the patents that have been lodged. Medical, whilst that's also been growing, is much lower in context of the technology innovation. But then when you look at these patents, the question of, well, where are these coming from arises. You know, and you may expect, you know, some of this to be Silicon Valley, you may expect that to be Europe. But the next graph starts to shed a very different light on that. And it's clear from this, Europe led up until the 1990s in terms of the patents and some of the innovation. But then Asia started to grow. And looking at this, the rise has continued over the last 5 to 10 years. But we have to be cautious here around patents and not treat that as a direct correlation to disruption and innovation. The advent of patents clearly is an indicator, but the ability to commercialize these ideas is probably more important, and how these turn into business solutions. But one thing's for sure, this kind of graph in terms of where the patents are actually being lodged is an indicator of where there is innovation and an environment that is fostering a lot of collaboration and discovery. Oceania is clearly right at the bottom there, and that may well represent the numbers of people in the area, but the next slide starts to bring that into context a lot more. Our proximity becomes very relevant. the internet penetration rate, the percentage of the population that's online. So Australia, I mean, I was going to say circles, but they're actually more like dots. The circles and the dots represent the size of the population that's online. And Australia is amongst the leaders. It's not the leader. There are a few others just above it. But at over 80% penetration, that's a very high population, that a high number of the population that are online. And as you move down through Europe, Americas, and you get to Asia, which has a penetration rate of around 30%. And that's when it gets interesting, because Asia clearly has the largest number of people in terms of the continent. It has the lowest penetration rate. And even if we assume that's conservatively going to grow to 40% over the next 3 to 5 years, that effectively doubles the number of people on the internet. And that's a very conservative projection. Now, some of you might, who are involved in sales and looking at products and services, might be rubbing your hands and think, well, it's a billion more users on the internet over the next 5 years. But I can guarantee those people who get on the internet won't just be buying. They'll be selling and they'll be disrupting. And they'll be disrupting many of the traditional leaders that we see today. I'm sure many of you have heard of Alibaba, Chinese e-commerce giant, which is now handling more sales than eBay and Amazon combined. And that's just one of them. There are many others like that in China. So against this backdrop of opportunity, risk, and also challenges the traditional leaders are going to be faced with, how do you deal with this disruption? Clearly, learning from the disruptors and the disrupted is one thing. But many books and many articles have been written on how to survive in this digital era. And it comes down to three golden rules when you look at some of the successes and some of the failures. Three golden rules that as a business need to think about and the questions to ask. First of those is a conscious decision to make your digital strategy. Are you going to be an innovator? And are you going to disrupt yourselves? And are you going to disrupt others? Or are you going to be a fast follower by looking at others' ideas, improving them, adapting them, and then making sure you're there soon after them? Or are you going to focus on continuous improvement? Nothing wrong with that. And just chip away and make your products cheaper, better, faster through continuous focus. What really is important in this is to make that conscious decision. And it's akin to what you would see in a boardroom as a risk appetite statement. In this day and age, a digital strategy is critical in terms of where you sit on that spectrum. The second golden rule relates to culture. And this comes into some of the things that obviously Paul talked about and Pip mentioned as well. And how do you create that culture at the various levels? But in an organizational sense, companies that are very well governed and are risk averse find it hard to innovate and disrupt themselves. They're so well managed. And so they're finding a way of experimenting, testing and learning, and making sure the culture can accept a fast fail of a project that doesn't work. Those are the kind of things that need to be established. And some of these things may well be in a subsidiary, and it may not be possible to do it in the mainstream organization. And in particular, if some of your innovation is going to eat into your own products, because that's when the dilemma arises, the Kodak, the General Motors situation. The third golden rule relates to collaboration. Partnerships across with the technology leaders, where the innovation is coming out of but then yet needs to be applied, is critical. And partnerships with suppliers, upstream, downstream, and looking at the integration horizontally and vertically, that's critical. Partnerships with universities. And how you create an ecosystem where your customers and your suppliers can interact with you sitting in the middle as a business. Many of the leaders have applied these three golden rules. If you look at Apple, a constant focus on their culture, on R&D, innovation. Creating an ecosystem of iTunes where both developers and businesses interact. And when they launched the iPhone, it wasn't successful just because of the device. they had struck deals with the telecommunications companies right up front to ensure their plans were subsidized and data wasn't going to be an issue. Then there's IBM. It introduced the PC many years ago. It didn't just arrive as a PC, it arrived with MS-DOS on it. That was a partnership behind the scenes. Amazon, not just a seller of books, it's actually now a broker between suppliers and businesses who want to sell using their platform. So what does that mean? What does that mean for a central bank such as us then? Are we facing digital disruption as well, and what's our role in this? Well, we too have to deal with digital disruption, just like other firms. But our objective is to promote a secure and stable environment within which other participants can innovate. So a few examples from an internal and an external perspective. From an internal perspective, we adopt a lot of the innovation that comes out from these technology leaders. We have to. Our systems need to be secure, stable, and industry-leading. We run a server environment that's 80% virtualized, which is industry-leading, which allows us to offer an environment that's faster, is cheaper, and more agile for the many participants that have to test with us. And you could call that an industry testing cloud, an environment that's there for other participants to interact in. Another example is flexibility for our workforce. So we have introduced a bring-your-own-device policy for iPhones and iPads. And that uptake has been huge over the last 2 years, almost up to 30% adoption rate across the organization on BYOD. Clearly, people have taken that up in the flexibility it offers and the convenience in terms of their working habits. And then as we look externally, creating an ecosystem for payments where banks, large and small, can provide real-time payment services to their customers and offer additional innovation on top of that. So just in closing, what's really clear from the landscape we looked at, that there are many waves of digital disruption around us, and it's really important to work out what disruption means in your context and to make sure it doesn't get lost within continuous improvement. The opportunities are there, but the biggest risk is not doing anything and just waiting until that disruption impacts you. And in terms of applying those learnings, the leaders who have disrupted and those that have been disrupted offer many of those golden rules, a conscious strategy around digital, a culture and collaboration. But most important of all, building the plans into your corporate conversation and making sure they're embedded into your goals and also your cultural DNA. Thank you for listening.
Philip Isaacs, I'm Managing Director of Innovision Australia for Brighton Limited. My question, I suppose, is directed to the Microsoft end of the group there, but probably each of you. Will innovation and growth increase or decrease the level of security for personal intellectual property and data? I'm concerned that most people I talk to are worried about access to their data on the whole internet scene. So is the research going into improving the levels of security?
From my perspective, the importance of privacy is extremely critical, particularly in this growth period around digital. And a lot of the work around security as well is probably hidden, but there's some key pieces of research happening across the industry on how to safeguard consumers in this more online world, both in terms of children and how to protect them from the nasties out there, but also how to safeguard data. And I know Nicta is doing a lot of deep work around encryption and how to make that available to the right people. But a lot of those innovations are sitting behind the front end that you see when you consume the service. It's working with the IT suppliers, it's working with the research houses, and inevitably for the trust to be maintained in online and digital, it's actually critical that consumers and businesses feel safe in that environment.
Peter Leonard from Gilbert and Tobin. We've talked a lot about digital disruption. I think one constancy that I've seen in 30 years of working in the technology sector is that too many parents want smart kids to do law and medicine and too many smart kids continue to do law and medicine. And we briefly mentioned before the decline in enrolments in STEM skills in universities. I think that we've got a much deeper problem, and that is that our schools, our career counsellors in schools, our teachers in schools, don't actually understand what disruption is meaning and where the skills needs are for Australia today, let alone a decade away. And further, I think the universities have been incredibly slow to innovate as well. I had a look a little while back at computer science curricula at a number of the major universities, because I'm trying to talk my son out of doing law and doing something useful instead. And the curricula read like a network administrator's skill set of a decade ago. It was just remarkable, really. So it's really to throw out the challenge. How do we actually get through to 14-year-olds what the world's going to be like and what the skills are that they should be developing, those STEM skills, when the schools don't get it and the career counsellors don't get it?
Look, that's it comes down to the ecosystem or the environment you create. And it's not just about looking at the schools and addressing that, because once you've looked at that, then the next phase, you know, that I see is when you go to the graduate recruitment fairs, the blue chip companies are there, but the startups are not there. So it's actually about addressing not just the educational aspects and making sure the innovation and the disruptive skills are being taught at an early age, but the right controls are being set up beyond that, whether it's universities or whether it's employment taking a year out to try and create a startup, or whether it's actually putting in some kinds of incentives for investors to invest in startups and create more of that know-how. I mean, certainly in looking at graduates, we take on a lot of graduates within the technology function within RBA, and yes, we have to compete with other banks and other firms for that prime talent. But also what we're seeing increasingly, and maybe it's not just not a factor of the education, but many of them are choosing now to go to the startup world themselves because they've seen the lures of Silicon Valley. They think they can do the next Facebook, and they should. So the challenge is actually not just competing with the other banks to find talent, but it's actually the startup world. And that's just happened through natural culture that we're working within, and it's obviously not as strong as it needs to be, you know, as Pip said earlier. But clearly addressing multiple points in schools, universities, and the right incentives to encourage innovation, that's the only way over time we're going to accelerate some of these the desperately needed skills.
Thank you very much. So my name is Ian Offerman. I'm CEO of a disruptive company based here in Sydney, doing financial services and venturing into agricultural services. I feel particularly privileged to be part of this conversation today because I worked at Nokia during those exciting times. I have been to Senate Estimates, which is very exciting. And I've had the opportunity to participate in a number of conversations like this over the last 4 or 5 years. I'm just wondering, given that a lot of the issues that are being talked about here are issues that we know and begin to understand a little more deeply, will we still be having this conversation in 5 years' time? And if the answer is yes, will we be having this conversation in 10 years' time, specifically around digital disruption?
I'll kick off. I think these conversations will be had in 5-10 years' time. But our concept of digital will change. I mean, we thought we'd have had it figured 10 years ago when PCs were on every desk. And then mobiles are now wearable technology. So I think the pace at which we're going, the definition of digital will be dramatically different in 5 years' time, and we'll be grasping different challenges. And that growth that I talked about on online, that's going to be a key factor in this part of the world for us, is how we deal with that opportunity and that risk. So I think the discussions will be the same. The venue might be different, but and the challenges will be different, but I think the topic and the core theme will be the same.